So I'm pleased to introduce Andrew Lee as our first speaker. He'll be well known to everybody here, I'm sure, and I won't take any time to introduce him. He's written extensively on aspects of inequality and worked with some of the world's top social scientists, Robert Putnam, Christopher Jenks, and Tony Atkinson, to mention three rather eminent social scientists. His latest book, Battlers and Billionaires, was published earlier this year. If you haven't got it, you should get it. Buy it, rather, not just get it. Buy it, I think, Andrew. But I'm sure Andrew will tell us more about what's in that book in his speech. So, Andrew Lee.
Thank you, Peter, for a very generous introduction. And can I, of course, acknowledge for meeting on the traditional lands of the Ngunnawal people and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. I'm really grateful to Susan and Sheila and Peter for inviting me here today. Particularly grateful, too, to Lars for agreeing to swap around our places. I have to go and sign in as a Member of Parliament a bit after 10 o'clock. It's something that you have to do as a Member of Parliament, whether or not you're a billionaire or a battler. So let me start with a quick metaphor. Imagine a ladder in which each rung represents $1 million of household wealth. On that ladder, about half of Australian households sit between the ground and halfway to the first rung. If you're in the top tenth of Australian households, you're 1.5 rungs up. In order to get into the top 10% of household wealth, you need about $1.5 million. If you're in the top 1%, you're 5 rungs up. I guess about here, if the ladder was standing next to me. Gina Reinhart is 10 kilometres off the ground. Why does inequality matter? Well, one way is to think about the classic Rawlsian experiment. Imagine there were two distributions, two wealth distributions, and that you could be born into any of the fifth, any fifth of the population. Distribution one sets out one possible wealth distribution. Distribution two shows another, and distribution two is slightly more unequal than distribution one. If you knew you had an equal chance of being born into any one of those fifths, you would probably prefer distribution one. As it turns out, distribution one is about what household wealth looked like in Australia in the late 60s. Distribution two is what the distribution of household wealth looks like today. The top fifth holds about 62% of wealth, the bottom fifth less than 1% of wealth. Now, I don't have very long today, so what I wanted to do was to give you a brief potted overview of what's happened to inequality in Australia going back to the late 1700s. I don't have great data, such as Peter has shown you for recent years, so what I'm going to be presenting is a pastiche of evidence, a range of different data sources, which will put together the picture of what's going on. The first data source I want to show you is the number of people on the all-time rich list. William Rubenstein put together a book based on probate records and biographical data, in which he tracked the number of people who had a wealth above 0.17% of GDP. And I've shown the number of people who were sort of in their prime wealth years going back from 1788 through to 2013. And if inequality had stayed constant, you'd expect that grey line to be pretty much a flat line, an equal distribution of billionaires right through the period. But in fact, what you see is that from the period shortly after white settlement, inequality in Australia rose rapidly. At the point of white settlement, there actually wasn't that much inequality. Indigenous Australians, like most hunter-gatherer communities, were fairly equal. Take the simple thought experiment, how equal would Australia be if each of us could only keep the possessions we could carry on our backs? And that gives you a sense of egalitarianism among Indigenous Australians, in terms at least of wealth and income, if not power. And white settlers, much the same. Work by Mark Thomas, looking at the distribution of rations, suggests quite an equal distribution among the early settlers in Botany Bay. One illustration of that is that invitations to dine at Government House with Arthur Phillip in the early years bore on the bottom the inscription, "Please bring your own bread." When everyone's close to starvation, you simply can't afford too much inequality. But then through the land grants, inequality increases rapidly. Land was given to those who were more productive and also to those who were better connected, such as the Wentworth family. And that's one of the reasons why we see this rise in the all-time rich listers through the 1820s and 1830s. Little drop around the 1850s, but then again, another peak. And I'll come to the drop and the rise further down. Another way in which we can look at inequality is to look at a measure of how many days a manufacturing worker would have to work to buy a hectare of farmland. What does it take, in other words, for someone in the toiling classes to break into the landed classes? In the 1860s, the answer was about 4 days' work to buy a hectare of land. By the outbreak of World War I, that was closer to 20, 25 days. So on this different measure, we again see the same sort of picture, a rapid rise in inequality right through to the period around World War I. World War I was a tough war if you were poor. Wages were frozen, but prices weren't, and so the buying power of many Australians declined. Unemployment was high, and many went off to World War I carrying just what they had on their backs. But then, somewhere around that point, we see the turning point. With Tony Atkinson, I've tracked top incomes using taxation data going back to the period around World War I. And this shows you the increase in egalitarianism in Australia from around about the 1920s to the 1970s. One social account of the 1960s described Australia as a place where the rich feel a need to be accepted by the rest rather than the other way around. Australia was a country in which manufactured goods were more accessible for the average worker. The average manufacturing worker would have had to work 2 years to buy a new Holden in the 1940s, but by the 50s that was down to 1 year. Housing became more accessible, and of course the experience of World War II itself was much more egalitarian than World War I. In World War II, more of the manufacturing took place onshore, as Ian MacLean has pointed out in Why Australia Prospered. In World War II also, prices and wages were fixed, and the experience of high income tax rates in World War II had an egalitarian impact. And so we see the top 1% share go from about 12% in the 1910s and 1920s, about 12 times their proportionate share, down to just 5% in 1980. The low point of Australian inequality on the top incomes measure was the period in which Malcolm Fraser was Prime Minister of Australia, illustrating that not everything about top incomes can be explained by politics. But then you see the rise. I've shown here two series for the top 1%, either the series of mine with Tony Atkinson, or else, and alongside that, a valuable series which has been put together by Marcus Bruckner, Richard Wilkins and Richard Birkhauser, which takes out capital gains. But on either measure, we see a rise in inequality over recent years, doubling of the top 1% share and a tripling of the top 0.1% share. That's true also if we turn to earnings. This is adjusting for inflation. This is earnings for the bottom tenth and the top tenth, and then at the middle, looking over the last 3.5 decades. And over that period, you've seen a 59% increase in wages at the top 10%, but only a 15% increase for the bottom 10%. Put another way, if bottom 10% wages had risen at the same pace as top 10% wages, then bottom 10% workers would be earning $14,000 more every year. We also see this when we look at wealth shares. In work that I've done with Pamela Katic, we've put together three different sources of data on wealth inequality. We've put together for the early period the census estimates of wealth inequality, the wealth census taken in Australia in 1915, then spliced that on to a state tax series using the Tony Atkinson's measure of thinking of estate taxes as being a random wealth sample of the population, conditional on age. Slightly macabre, I'll grant you, but it turns out to be quite a good proxy for wealth inequality. And again, we see the great compression taking place even more starkly when we look at this wealth share measure. Top 1% wealth share going down from something around 34% to under 10% in the 1970s, and then rising again with the last numbers coming from the Hilda survey. We can indeed go even further and look at the very top of the distribution. We have data from the BRW Rich List, and if you torture your interns enough, they'll take all of the BRW Rich List data, put it in Excel spreadsheets, and allow you to analyse those data year by year. Those BRW Rich Lists allow us to look at wealth shares at the tippy top of the distribution, the top 0.001% and the top 0.0001%. And again, we see a rise in this measure of wealth inequality, approximately tripling at the very top of the distribution. Indeed, if all you had was the pages of the BRW, had nothing else, you would probably still have a hint that inequality was rising, because the share of BRW Rich List wealth held by the top quarter has gone from 2/3 to 3/4 over this period. This is one of the sort of norms we often see in changes in inequality, that a rise in the gap between the 90-10 tends to be accompanied by a rise in the ratio of incomes from the top 1% to the top 10%, and even within the richest 200 people in Australia. Indeed, if all you had was consumption data, you'd probably still have a hint that something was going on. Over the last couple of decades, we've seen a doubling of Porsche sales, quintupling of Maserati sales, rise in the prices of waterfront homes, an increase in the rates of plastic surgery, and indeed an increase in the rates of consumption of cocaine, what Robin Williams once called God's way of telling you you're making too much money. So whether you've got the income data, the wealth data, the consumption data, the picture is quite similar. An Australia which became more unequal from 1788 through to about World War I, and then became more equal from World War I through to about 1980. And then again, the turning point, the increase in inequality over the last generation or so. Where has Australia ended up? Well, across developed countries, of course, we're not as unequal as Latin America, as the United States. We're not as unequal as Latin America, albeit not developed. But we are in the top third of inequality, at least on the OECD's Gini figures. So what's caused these changes in inequality? Well, in my view, there's three big factors. There's the rise in superstars, driven by technology and globalisation, whose effects are hard to unpick from one another. A top lawyer, a top accountant, a top CEO now earns more in Australia than their also-ran counterparts. There has been, in both technology and globalisation have acted as a force multiplier for those at the top of their game. When I worked as a law firm in Sydney in the starting in the early 1990s, the best partners were serving the best Sydney clients. By the end of the 90s, the best Sydney partners were servicing the best Australian clients. Now the best Sydney partners are servicing the best Asia-Pacific clients, and their wages have increased commensurately. Technology and globalisation have both played a part in that rise of earning capacity for those at the top of their profession. We've also seen deunionisation of the labour market. This is a graph showing trade union membership and inequality. Going back, splicing together a couple of trade union membership series. And so the union membership series is the dark line here. You can see it rises through the early part of the series up until World War I, stays stable about half the labour market, and then collapses through the 80s and even more rapidly through the 90s. Alongside that, I've set a series, which I put together as part of my PhD thesis, of male Gini coefficients. Using the tax data on the basis that for going back until the end of World War II, a very large share of men paid tax, and you can put together census data and tax data to get a reasonable series of male earnings inequality. And again, that tracks similarly and rises significantly in the period of deunionisation. The third factor is changes in top marginal tax rates. This is two measures of the top tax rate, either the top tax rate itself or the tax rate paid by the last person who scrapes into the top 1%. You can see that during World War I, we really ramped up those top tax rates, over 90%. But in fact, they weren't being paid by someone just on the margin of the top 1%. They were being paid only by a very small share of Australians. But since about 1980, the top tax rate is the rate that's paid by someone just scraping into the top 1%. And on either measure, you see this hump shape, which is, of course, the inverse of what you see out of the inequality data. So big drivers of inequality, I regard, as being the superstar labour markets, unions and taxation, with education running in the opposite direction. Australia would have more inequality today were it not for the fact that we've increased school completion rates and university attendance rates. Claudia Golden and Larry Katz's book, The Race Between Technology and Education, is, I think, a useful way of regarding inequality and with the notion that when technology advances faster than education, the gap widens. When education advances faster than technology, there's a compressing effect. What do we do about inequality? I think the first thing to focus upon is making sure that we have rapid rates of economic growth. Recessions hurt the poor most, and it's hard to find examples of countries which are generous to the poor domestically and abroad that aren't enjoying significant economic growth. Next, I think it's important that we make sure we focus on educational disadvantage. One of the worrying facts I found out a bit about this is the relationship between test score inequality and earnings inequality. Countries where there's a big gap between the best and worst performing kids at school are also countries where there's a big gap between the highest earning and lowest earning workers. But lastly, I think we need to also remember the egalitarian spirit in Australia. There's an account from World War II of the Japanese prisoner of war camps in which Gavin Dawes asked the question, what would you expect the character of men to be when starved down, less than 2,000 calories a day, with a body weight of less than 100 pounds? You'd expect the national differences to disappear, wouldn't you? And he said, in fact, the opposite was the case. When you look at those prisoner of war camps, the Americans were the cowboys. They were the ones that ran the rice loan scheme, in which you could have an additional ration of rice today, but you had to pay two back tomorrow. And ultimately, the debt became so large that the man would end up paying for it with his life. The British, said Dawes, hung on to their class structure like bulldogs. The officers were given higher rations and they ate those higher rations. They were given better tents and they slept in those tents. And the Australians put together their little male-bonded welfare states. They put the sickest in the tents, they shared out the rations, and by the end of the period, according to Tom Uren, one of my predecessors in Parliament, dysentery and cholera had ravaged the British camps. The death rate was far higher among the British than the Australians. Australia is a country where we don't stand up when the Prime Minister enters the room. We don't like tipping. We tend to sit in the front seat of taxis. But I think there's a risk that that egalitarian ethos is now coming adrift from the economic reality of rising inequality. I think egalitarianism is important from Rawlsian and perhaps even some instrumental arguments. I think our nation is stronger when we bond together than when we pull apart. Thanks very much.
Okay, we have a bit over 5 minutes, between 5 and 10 minutes for questions. So if I could ask people to identify themselves when they speak, that would be useful, I think, for everyone. Who would like to start? Is that the hand up there in the middle? Yes. There are microphones coming. Sorry, I should have said that.
I'm Jenny Clark from Homelessness Australia. Andrew, I was interested in your comments about globalisation and why you confined them to the labour market rather than to other things like the property market or the equities market or globalisation of the currency.
Jenny, I guess I don't see the same sorts of effects going on, at least yet, in the property market. You're certainly seeing a little bit of additional demand from foreign investors, but the overall share of homes being purchased by foreign investors is still relatively low. In the equities market, more foreign investors I don't think of as intuitively having a significant impact on the Australian on Australian inequality, but maybe there's channels through which that could operate. Certainly the other issue your question highlights, though, is why we would look at Australian inequality at all when the gaps in the world are so much larger than the gaps just within Australia. And I guess that perhaps speaks to the importance of national benchmarks for many of us, that we do compare ourselves to other Australians, albeit that the gaps in the world are larger still.
Front, yeah.
Jeff Harcourt, I wonder whether you've considered some ideas which started with James Mead, went through the Leontief and Ben Friedman's just raised, and that is the nature of technical progress relative to the attainments of natural attainments of people in populations. With globalisation, Mead predicted, and Ben has just described in a recent article in the New York Review of Books, how globalisation has produced a huge virtual underclass of people, because the gap between your ability to work with the nature of machines of tech going on with technical progress and human attributes has widened, and whether you think that might also be an important cause of inequality.
It's a great question, Jeff. Certainly there's some downward pressure of technology and immigration on certain occupations in Australia. So we think of textile workers in the early 1980s, many of whom lost their jobs as we brought down the tariff barriers. For others, there isn't a threat from globalisation. Your hair will always be cut by someone in Australia, so hairdressers don't face that same sort of threat. At the top, I think about the classic example that economists use when we're talking about superstars, the earnings of opera singers Elizabeth Billington in the early 1800s and Pavarotti in our time. Billington's greatest earnings came from singing to a packed-out hall in Covent Garden. Pavarotti's came from millions of CD sales and music downloads worldwide. So Pavarotti's income relative to average incomes were many multiples higher than Billington, even although there's arguments that Billington was the better singer of the two. Pavarotti benefited from the force multiplier of both technology and globalisation intertwined in ways that I think makes it hard to separate them.
David Peets from Griffith University in Queensland. Andrew, it's great to see you give this talk, and it's also great to see a thinker in Parliament. And I really enjoyed the talk, but the one thing, my little thought experiment for you is, if globalisation of labour markets is one of the key responsible factors, then what would happen to inequality in the US? And my response would be, well, the top incomes in the US would tend towards those in the rest of the world, as the rest of the world tended towards those in the US. But in fact, the data you and others have shows that inequality in the US is increasing by even more than it has been in Australia elsewhere, and the gap between the top in the US and Australia has been widening, not narrowing. So, and although the superstar argument, I think, has got a lot of legs in terms of entertainers and so on, I don't think for a lot of the people in the top 0.1% and the like, in the CEOs and the law firms and so on, that it really explains what's going on. And I think you have to go to explanations that are much more about relative power than about globalisation.
David, it is likewise terrific to have you among us, and I should have given you a shout-out before as somebody who's looked at those unionisation data better than anyone else. I think unions explain a part of what's going on, and maybe that's one of the dynamics through which the power relationship plays out. Certainly in the United States, as you say, the gaps are larger than they are here. At least when I showed the earnings series, our bottom 10% earnings after inflation had gone up 15%. In the United States, for 40 years, the bottom 10% have not seen real increases in their earnings. And I think Wayne Swan was right to evoke Bruce Springsteen on this, to think what it means psychologically when you see your children not able to earn any more than you were, and sometimes less. And when we look at it, the top 1% series, our top 1% has doubled, theirs has doubled, but ours has ended up where theirs started. Ours has roughly gone from 5 to 10, theirs roughly from 10 to 20. So their inequality at a much greater scale, and things like employment at will in the southern states, I think, are a factor driving the power imbalance there in the labour market, as you say.
I think we'll bring this session to a close. Well, let's take one more question. If you can keep it reasonably brief. Yeah, sure. Just down.
John Holmes from Queensland. In your book, you propose 8 policy directions towards reducing the impact of inequality in Australia. As a parliamentarian with a chance to start implementing some of those policies, which one would you give the highest priority to?
So, John, I think this answer should probably reflect the fact that I'm part of a political party that just lost office. In terms of if I was playing defence, I would talk about the importance of maintaining a means-tested welfare state. Peter Whiteford has done very important work showing that Australia's welfare state is the most redistributive in the OECD. Benefits going to the top, to the bottom fifth, 12 times what goes to the middle, compared to 5 times in the typical OECD country. And I think policies like a regressive paid parental leave scheme do risk undermining that. But if I was playing offence, I'd focus on the educational thing. I think it's unconscionable that so many Australian teachers begin their careers teaching disadvantaged kids and finish their careers teaching advantaged kids. Now, that's a hard problem to solve because it's not just about resources. But getting the narrowing the educational gaps, I think, is tremendously important work to be done. Since that's my last answer, let me again express how sorry I am not to be spending the day with so many friends here today. I really enjoyed the conversation and wish I could be here for more of it. Thank you.